Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
As you all know, I've talked about Mu any number of times over the years. And Mu is a koan, and the koan reads, a monk asks Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu responds, Mu. M-U, Mu. And part of the heart of this koan is Buddha nature. Does a dog have Buddha nature, yes or no? So before going back to the koan, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Buddha nature. And most often, Buddha nature is talked about in terms of humans. And the idea is that the Buddha nature we carry in ourselves, each one of us carries the seed for realizing our Buddha nature. And the metaphor is always the seed needs to be planted, the seed needs to be watered, and the seed needs sunlight. And over time, if it's taken care of properly, eventually the seed becomes a flower. So that's the same way that we view the metaphorical seed in us. You know, we have our foundation, we sit, and we water ourselves with the experience of sitting, with the teaching, and taking this into our everyday life. And over time, if we do this, over and over and over again, just like taking care of a plant, the idea is that eventually this seed grows in us and we awaken. Another part of this that gets mentioned is that the seed is limited to human beings that have a particular kind of consciousness. Now, the discussion about this consciousness goes into great depth, and there are books that are written about it, so I'm not going to go into that. But that there's a certain kind of awareness that goes with the realization of Buddha nature. Now, His Holiness the Dalai Lama expanded this somewhat when he said that Buddha nature extends to insects and the natural world. But he doesn't, in the stuff that I've come across, talk about the insects having the seed of awakening in them, and that if they develop or take care of the seed, there will be some kind of awakening, right? Because insects, the natural world, doesn't really have the kind of consciousness that awakens. Now, there's another way that Buddha nature is looked at in the Buddhist world, the Zen world. And this understanding takes into account a broader perspective. And it does not replace what I just talked about, but it adds onto it, expands it, and I would say gives it even more life. And this view goes beyond sentient beings who have or have not Buddha nature. So I always like to bring in the other points of view, and one of them comes from Thich Nhat Hanh, who was asked at a particular time, can a Buddha be recognized in a form other than human? And when he was asked this question, he responded, we need to remove dualistic thinking regarding inanimate objects. Even a rock has Buddha nature. And then he goes on to say that we need to transcend the idea that Buddha must be human. And to me, what he is saying, and which has been said before, that all things have Buddha nature. Now, David Loy, who is a scholar and author and also a Zen teacher, in talking about the environment, said, we desecrate the natural world when we relate to it only as an instrument, a means to some other goal, such as economic growth. We sacralize it when we realize and respect its own Buddha nature. So in a different context, in essence, he's saying the same thing. So us guys, us human beings, are capable of attaining Buddhahood, and in a particular way for human beings. That's how we see it. But at the same time, we coexist interdependently with all of the universe. There's no separation between beings who are enlightened, and the rest of existence. All things have Buddha nature. But this is not a philosophy. It's based on experience. And I was thinking about this. One of the teachings in Zen is about emptiness. And really, the entire universe is empty. And in this emptiness, or from this emptiness, arise all these different objects, beings, energies. All these things arise out of emptiness, and we name these things. But it's Buddha nature. The Buddha nature of emptiness is that everything is connected to everything else, that it's all part of one oneness. So this is a little bit about how do we work with Mu. And Mu, by the way, not everybody is temperamentally connected to doing koan work. So it's not this or that. It's in harmony with whoever we are, whether or not we are suited to using koans as a way of awakening, or sitting and just developing our sitting practice. So when teachers talk about koans, a lot of times it creates the impression that, oh, if you do Zen, you do koans. Well, koans are precious. But other ways of sitting and developing the depth of our practice also happens. And, you know, historically, it's broken up in this way, but really they're all interconnected. There's Rinzai Zen, which is based on koan work, and then there's Soto Zen, which is based on what we call just sitting. Suzuki Roshi from the San Francisco Zen Center was a Soto teacher, and most of you know about him and the ways in which he taught. So back to working with Mu. For this talk, I wrote a haiku. Gray clouds above the roof, the moon unseen. Gray clouds above the roof, the moon unseen. So to go back to the koan, the monk asks Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu replies, Mu, which means not, without, no. Now surely Joshu, who was one of the renowned Zen masters of all time, knew that everything had Buddha nature. So why would he answer no? Why would he pick or choose yes or no? So there was one, Yamada Roshi was a famous Japanese Zen master who spent some time in the U.S. And he had an encounter in Daisan with a trainee. And this was at Daikokuji, a major temple which is in Kyoto. And I believe it's still there. So the trainee responds to the Joshu's answer with Mu in a particular way. He comes in and he sits down in front of Yamada and he's Mu, putting himself into Mu 100%. And in response, Yamada calmly dismisses him without comment to the effect that the answer must come deep within and not be pronounced by the lips alone. And so after the student presents his Mu, 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 shouting Mu, Yamada rings the bell and that time is up. And he's ready to interview the next student. So as I'll get into a bit, the ringing of the bell is wonderful. So it's important, and this happens a lot with studying this particular koan, and other koans too, but Mu should not be considered an object of study because it can't be expressed in any conventional sense. Now you could flip it the other way though. On the other hand, it can be expressed in any way, if that expression does not come from lips alone. There's a Zen teacher, Jan Chosen Bays, who you've probably come across. She's written a number of books, and she's an American Zen teacher. And she is the leader of the Zen community of Oregon. And she writes in Always at Home, we must be able to let go and let Mu work on us. So there's a subtle difference, right? We're not working with Mu. We're allowing Mu to work on us. And she says, this happens when Mu penetrates every breath, every footstep, every blink, every touch, every sound. Raindrops falling, Mu, 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 Mu. Crows calling, Mu, Mu, Mu. Hands pick up Mu and spoon Mu into a bowl. And at the same time, all of these activities as an aggregate are Mu. So the following lines are from Pablo Neruda's poem, Keeping Quiet. So in this poem, he says, "Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much." When we are silent, we realize mu. So part of this is about surrender. If we surrender, mu will silence our mind. And when we are silent is when we have the opportunity to realize our Buddha nature. And also, in the process, seeing into this koan. I've mentioned this before, but I think there was a couple of things in this that I think help. I don't know if I mentioned it with regard to mu or not, but as you know, that when I entered Zen with Roshi Kennedy, I sat for a while, and at some point I said, "Roshi, can I try doing koans?" And so, of course, this is the first koan in the first book that we use in our lineage, and that's the Mumen Kan, or the Gateless Gate. So the first koan, as I said, is mu. So that was my assignment. And my experience, now again, using this as a metaphor, because Roshi didn't use a bell, over and over again, I would go to Daisan and present my understanding of mu, and the bell would ring. Roshi would say something that would mean that Daisan is over. And so I would leave. Now this took place for years, going every week, once a week, going to Daisan in Jersey City, having the bell rung. And I remember after a while, I figured, you know, I wanted to give up. I thought, I'm never going to get this. And somewhere at the same time, though, it dawned on me that what's needed to practice, and in my case, practice koans, is to be patient and to be persistent. And I also realized, which I had started to do, is not to take the ringing of the bell personally. That's a big trap, you know, because that's about wanting to accomplish something and thinking about what others who are doing this are doing with their koan and comparing, and that whole mishigas that goes on with that. We shouldn't compare, and we shouldn't take falling on our face personally. Those things, the ring, the falling on the face, the getting frustrated, the comparing, they're all part of the teaching. So at a certain point, I finally surrendered to the truth of all this. And I gave up looking for an answer or the right response to the koan. And I decided to use mu as a mantra, not as a question to be answered. So I started breathing in an in-breath, and then the out-breath would be, and that's just what I did. Every time I sat, I breathed mu as a mantra. And so every day it was in-breath, out-breath. And what started to happen was I started doing this without even thinking about it. You know, sometimes I would realize that when I was breathing, just living my life, I was breathing mu. And somewhere in this 3 years, this was at a retreat, I also mentioned this before, One night I went out for a walk and I looked up in the sky. It was this beautiful star-filled sky, and I noticed Venus, which appears like a star because it's very bright, but it's not, it's a planet. And I saw Venus, and these things are very hard to explain, but my relationship with Venus, you know, me standing here looking up in the sky at Venus, somehow switched. It sort of flipped. And Venus was not the same anymore. My relationship was not the same anymore. And what I realized later on, it was the first taste of being at one. Right? It was in those few seconds, I realized that it wasn't Carl looking at Venus. So again, I could have gotten involved with a whole big intellectual relationship with the experience and what does it mean, and, you know, on and on and on. And I realized what my practice was, just go back to breathing mu. So a few months later, near the end of the 3 years, I was sitting, and again, these things are so difficult to describe or to, well, not explain, but to describe. But I was sitting, and I was somehow filled in my body and mind with this wave of energy. And all of a sudden, the words, the oneness of life, became an experience. I experienced directly the oneness of life. And what I'm talking about, what my experience was, is what Jan Bays talked about when she said, allow Mu to become you. So we're not going out there after Mu. We're surrendering and allowing ourselves to become Mu, to fill us with just Mu. So that's my talk for today, and thank you for listening.